On a different subject, you were discussing and telling us how, what rate you lost oil and when you lost the oil. Do you believe that if the inert gas had been, the pressure had been removed from the inert gas system, do you believe that this might have reduced the amount of oil spilled?
No.
Did you observe if the loss of oil was related to the tide conditions, that is, when you, on each low tide, did you begin to leak oil again?
No. From my recollection, after the first low tide, we became very stable as far as the discharge of oil. And any leakage on the following tides was either minimal or a sheen or none at all. Mm-hmm. It's my perception that within one cycle of the tide, the output of oil had ceased.
Mm-hmm. It has been said that in tankers like this one, designed like this and going aground, that if the if it does puncture the bottom and oil leaks out, the oil then, the ship then becomes lighter, and on the next high tide it floats off and can proceed. It didn't happen that way in this case. Can you give a reason you think why this didn't happen?
Well, because I don't think the ship got lighter. In other words, the ballast tanks filled up and offset a lot of that weight. The forepeak filled, two starboard and four starboard pretty much filled. So granted, it did get lighter, but we didn't get that much lighter. It wasn't as if none of the weight had been replaced.
You think that if the forepeak and the segregated ballast tanks had not been punctured, that you would have lost whatever you were about to lose, and that therefore you then would have been perhaps gotten off the ground?
I really don't know the answer to that. I'd have to, you know, you're hitting me with some very hypothetical situations, and if you'd like me to, we can sit down and try to figure them all out, but I can't, in the top of my head, answer questions like that.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
When we originally brought you up here, you described the vessel itself, its characteristics, and you said that basically once the vessel is loaded fully, the draft is 64 feet.
Yeah, that would be load line draft?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
For this particular voyage, loaded as it was, did you mean by that to imply that that was the draft on this as she departed the port?
No, sir.
Do you happen to know, or do we have the information as what draft was as she was proceeding,
approximately 56 feet.
Thank you, sir.
Within 2 or 3 inches, 56 feet.
Mr. Kunkel, I just have one or two for clarification. Some of our people and some of the parties have asked you questions about the captain, about Mr. Hazelwood. And you said that you did have a few conversations with him on the bridge that evening or that morning following the occurrence. I think you were asked by several people, did you smell anything on Mr. Hazelwood's breath? And I think you responded by saying no, but there were other vapors in the air. Did Mr. Hazelwood ever say anything to you about him drinking or about him having a drink?
No, sir.
At any time in the past, have you ever known of Mr. Hazelwood saying to anybody else on crew whether or not he has had a drink?
I'm not aware of him saying anything like that.
Okay, thank you. Let me ask you just a couple questions on course recorders. We've had a lot of discussion about Exhibit 2 Echo. How accurate are these, in your opinion, how accurate are these course recorders? Timing and heading.
Well, what would you like me to compare them to?
Well, let me ask the question a different way. How are they maintained, or when are they maintained? Are they recalibrated? Are they just calibrated once?
The second mate would normally be responsible for ensuring that the course recorder is recording the course. Are they calibrated?
How does he ensure that they're recording the course accurately?
Well, he checks that the gyro and the needle agree.
Okay.
That they're actually putting that on the paper.
In relation to, are they just calibrated once initially?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by calibrated. Every watch, you have to check it before you take the watch. That's standard routine. The first thing you do before you take the watch is ensure that the gyro and the course recorder agree.
So in other words, if there was some question yesterday with Mr. Cousins about the possibility of 6 or 7 or possibly 8 minutes difference between when some commands were given and when the heading seemed to change, if I remember that correctly. In your opinion, you don't think that there could be a 5-minute lag which could account for something like that?
I would assume, yes. That the,
yes.
That the course recorder should show what took place in 5 minutes?
No. That the course, my question is there any, without asking it that way, my question is, if a command is given and the heading changes, the course recorder should show that subsequent to that change? Or should it show that immediately?
If the heading is changing,
that's correct,
it should show it right away.
Thank you. Mr. Kunkel, thank you for your time this morning. You're excused. I'd like to call the next witness to the stand, Lieutenant Commander Thomas Falkenstein, Executive Officer, Marine Safety Office, Valdez.
You're listening to live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board hearings from downtown Anchorage. There's a hearings into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. This is brought to you by KSKA Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. We just heard from James Kunkel, who was the chief mate of the Exxon Valdez. And while he was not awake at the time, he had provided some interesting testimony into what exactly happened.
Our witness coming up to the stand right now and being sworn in is Lieutenant Commander Thomas G. Falkenstein. He's the executive officer for the Marine Safety Office of the Coast Guard in Valdez.
He was the first Coast Guard person to actually be on board the crippled tanker after it ran aground, and so his testimony will relate to that.
I'm assigned as the executive officer of the Marine Safety Office.
Do you have other collateral duties?
None per se. The executive officer covers a lot of territory.
I see. Okay. Mr. Woody, would you continue?
Mr. Falkenstein, how do you hear me?
Faintly.
How do you hear me now?
Much better.
Fine. How long have you been assigned to the Marine Safety Office at Valdez?
For approximately 2 years. I arrived in July of 1987.
Do you have a background in merchant marine inspection?
Yes.
Okay. Would you describe the purpose or the mission of the Marine Safety Office at Valdez?
Marine Safety Office in Valdez has got several missions. Marine environmental response, port safety and security, commercial vessel safety, marine casualty investigation, and vessel traffic control.
Briefly describe the organization and number of persons attached to the Marine Safety Office.
The authorized billet allowance for the Marine Safety Office is 37 persons. Right now we carry 44. The unit itself is broken down into 4 departments: operations department, Marine Safety Department, Administration Department, and the Public Works Department. I supervise the departments, and I work directly for the commanding officer.
Would you describe the vessel traffic center at the Marine Safety Office?
The Vessel Traffic Center is a branch of the Operations Department. It's located in its own spaces, a darkened room, and it's co-located with the radio center. It has three radar consoles, and one operator sits and monitors the three consoles.
Going back to the missions of the Marine Safety Office, what responsibilities do you have with regard to oil spills?
Myself or the office?
The office.
The office is charged with ensuring federal response to oil spills within Prince William Sound and the navigable waters of the United States within that sound.
Is there any breakdown as to minor, medium, and major oil spills?
Yes, there is.
Could you describe what those are and how your response would vary for each type of spill?
I don't remember the exact numbers, and it varies for inland versus external or coastal waters.
Well, for example, would a spill in port at the Alyeska terminal, would that, like there have been two in 1989, did they fall in the category of minor or medium or?
The first, the spill from the tank vessel Thompson Pass fell in the category of medium. It was 1,700 barrels, and the tank vessel Cove Leader, I believe, fell in the category of minor, but I'm not sure.
All right, that's fine. On the morning of the grounding of the Exxon Valdez, would you describe being notified and what you did up until the time that you arrived on board the Exxon Valdez?
I was notified about 0030 by Mr. Blanford, the vessel traffic watchstander. He told me that the Exxon Valdez had gone aground. I asked him if the commanding officer had been notified. He said that he had. So when I hung up, I called the commander. I met him, and we drove in together. We arrived at about 0040. The commander immediately got on the radio and was talking to the Exxon Valdez master, I presume. We discussed the situation. I listened to the conversation. Then I proceeded to notify Commander Rome at our district staff that a casualty had occurred, major casualty appeared to have occurred. And shortly after that, it was decided that I and Mr. Mark DeLosier would be going out to the ship. I returned home to gather some clothes, and when I came back, I found out that the pilot vessel Silver Bullet was en route to pick us up. I got on the Silver Bullet at about 2:30.
Okay. And about what time did you arrive on the Exxon Valdez?
About 3:30.
3:30, okay. When you arrived on the Exxon Valdez, what did you observe?
As we approached the Exxon Valdez, I think Mr. DeLosier asked the operator of the boat, well, actually, when we approached the Valdez, we traded vessels. We got off of the Silver Bullet and boarded the Chirikov. The operator of the Chirikov had been in the vicinity for some time, and he was able to give us a quick synopsis of what he'd observed. We proceeded to go around the port side of the vessel. The operator noted that there was a lot of oil on that side, so he requested that they relocate the pilot ladder to the starboard side so he'd keep his boat out of the oil as much as possible.
Were there any vapors on the port side that were apparent to you?
There were vapors all over the place that we could smell. Okay. I do not know what their exact percentage concentration was.
Okay. So then you boarded the vessel ultimately from the starboard side, went aboard. When you arrived on the bridge, what did you observe?
When I arrived on the bridge, I believe there were three of the vessel's crew on the bridge. I noted one individual pacing by himself on the starboard half of the bridge. I asked him if he was the master, and he pointed to another individual on the port side of the bridge in the corner, and I proceeded to go over and talk to the master.
All right. What did the master relate to you regarding the grounding?
In general terms, he related that they kind of rolled a couple of times and bumped a couple of times as they grounded, and that as the vessel came up hard, the heading swung approximately 90 degrees.
Did he say 90 degrees which way?
Well, from a southerly heading to a more easterly heading.
See, more westerly heading?
Oh, westerly, I'm sorry, yeah.
Right. Did he give you any indication of why the vessel was in that area to begin with?
He'd indicated to me that they were maneuvering to avoid ice.
Did he volunteer that he was on the bridge or off the bridge?
Not in that conversation.
Okay. About how many conversations did you have with the master regarding the grounding of the vessel?
Two.
So what was it, the first or second conversation that you acquired most of the information about the grounding?
About how the grounding occurred?
Yes, how the grounding occurred.
In the second conversation.
Could you just describe for us as best you can recall the contents of that conversation?
It was very brief. I wouldn't say it lasted more than 2 minutes. I was looking at the chart on the chart table, and he related to me that he wanted the third mate to commence a turn when they were abeam of Busby Island to get back into the lanes. But he said that the mate apparently made his turn a little bit late.
Did he mention to you about receiving any telephone calls from the third officer?
No.
You mentioned there were other people on the bridge. Who were they?
I later found out one of them, well, the individual I asked if he was the master, later turned out to be the third mate, and I do not know who the third person was.
Was it a man or a woman?
I don't remember.
Okay. Did you have any subsequent conversations with the chief officer?
I met with the chief officer probably around 5 o'clock. Find out what the status of his cargo tanks were.
All right, chronologically, let's go back to your meeting then with the master. Did you detect any odor of alcohol from the master at that time?
In the initial meeting, yes.
Would you characterize it as strong or obvious?
Obvious.
Okay. About how far from the master could you detect the odor of what it was apparently alcohol?
About 2.5 feet.
2.5 feet. What was this observed by Mr. Delosier?
Yes, it was.
Would you describe the events of any consultation you had between you and Mr. Delosier and any attempts to inform the commanding officer of the MSO about this?
Mr. Delosier called me out on the bridge wing. We had a conversation about it, and it was determined then that we needed to call and advise the commanding officer and take steps to get a blood alcohol test of some type done on the master.
Did you have any communications with the Marine Safety Office?
Yes, we did.
And what was that?
We immediately called by the MARSAT telephone system, and I advised the commanding officer what we'd found and requested that we get someone to test the crew, the people on watch, the mate, the master, the helm, and the lookout, and suggested that the state troopers be called in to bring a portable breathalyzer of some type.
I see. Was any consideration given to removing any of the crew for testing?
It was discussed briefly, but not at that time.
Okay. Was that ever considered a feasible option?
It could have been a feasible option, but it was a last option. It was not the preferred choice.
What was your rationale for not wanting to remove the captain from the vessel?
The master knew the vessel better than anyone who'd gone out there to do any regulatory or salvage assist or any of that, and we felt that it was necessary for him to be aboard.
Now, about what time was your first call to the commanding officer, the first notification that you gave him about the problem of alcohol?
Between 3:30 and 4 o'clock, okay. Ballpark.
Perhaps we could go through a chronology related to the telephone calls you made. First of all, about how many telephone calls did you make?
I believe it was five.
Five calls in what period of time? The number of calls made up until the time the corpsman arrived to take the samples, the toxicology samples.
Five.
Five calls, right.
He arrived during the fifth call.
Fifth call. Okay. And what other information did you provide to the commanding officer at that time in the first call? Did you tell him about the status of the ship? Or?
I explained to him what the status of the ship was, that it was leaking oil. The tanks that we suspected were holed.
Do you recall what your estimate of tanks holed were at that time?
I believe it was the centers 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and 1, 2, and 3 starboard.
Did you have any information about the amount of oil that had left the ship?
I believe the initial estimate that we were given shortly after arrival was 138,000 barrels.
Now, I recall hearing on the VTS transcript of the figure of 138,000 barrels. Do you have any time when that might have been received from the vessel?
No, sir.
This was a conversation between Commander McCall and the master of the Exxon Valdez. And the master, I believe, provided that particular figure, 138.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Did you ever get any increased estimates of the amount of cargo lost?
Yes, we did.
And about what time did you get those?
I believe around 7 o'clock, I got an estimate of 192,000 barrels.
All right. All right, if you can just recall and relate to us the events. And if you could frame them through the five phone calls up until the time that Corpsman Connors arrived on the vessel.
The second phone call involved a little more update on the vessel. I do not recall what time it was at. Give him a better update on the status of the vessel. He informed me that Trooper Fox was en route, and I'm not sure whether that's the one where he wanted me to call the office, you know, that he notified us to call the office via the Channel 13, or if it was a subsequent call. The third phone call, I advised him Trooper Fox had arrived. That was sometime after sunrise, so I presume somewhere between 6 and 7 a.m. I advised him Trooper Fox had arrived and that he did not have any kind of test kits.
Okay. All right.
The next phone call was a little more concerned trying to find out when we were going to get somebody out to conduct the blood alcohol testing. And he advised me that he'd work on it and probably be sending the corpsman, but he needed to do some more research to track him down and get him there. We do not have a corpsman assigned to our unit. And the final phone call was when Petty Officer Connor arrived. It was also to update the commander as far as the status of the vessel.
And how did Petty Officer Connor arrive on the vessel?
I believe he arrived by helicopter.
Coast Guard helicopter?
No, sir. Alaska helicopter.
Do you have any knowledge on how Petty Officer Connor was located and why he was in Valdez at that time?
Petty Officer Connor was in Valdez on temporary duty to assist our personnel with updating medical records and arranging for a contract medical support from the local hospital.
Okay. What breakdown in work or task did you and Chief Warrant Officer Delosier have?
Almost immediately after reporting aboard, say within the first hour, he and I decided that he would take charge of the investigation activities and I would concentrate on salvage and pollution response.
Now, just a question on the toxicology. Did you learn at some point that there were toxicology kits on board the vessel?
Yes.
And how did you acquire that information?
From Commander McCall.
Okay. And what about what telephone conversation might that have been obtained in, or what time?
Somewhere between 7 and 10.
Did you see the toxicology kits?
No.
When you heard that they might have, when you were informed by the CO that the vessel might have toxicology kits on board, what did you do then?
I informed Mr. Delosier.
And do you know what he did?
No.
Did he make any reports back to you?
Not immediately.
Okay. When was the next report that you received about the toxicology testing from Mr. Delosier?
Shortly before Petty Officer Connor arrived.
And what did he say to you?
He related to me that they found the tox kits and they were taking your analysis samples of the people that we needed to get them from. He also indicated that the master was having a little bit of reluctance filling one of the bottles.
And you say that Petty Officer Connor, the Coast Guard hospital corpsman, or arrived during the fifth phone call?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Did, right. Would you describe the situation of the vessel when daylight arrived? What could you see in the way of a list, oil around the vessel, and this sort of thing?
In the daylight, the vessel had a slight starboard list coming back a little more to an even keel. Low tide, I believe, was about 8:30 that morning. There was oil around the vessel. It did not appear to be bubbling up as it had when we arrived at 3:30.
Would you describe the oil bubbling up when you did arrive?
When we arrived, we could see a fairly healthy boil along the starboard side of the ship where oil was coming up the side of the vessel.
What portions of the hull along the starboard side, can you relate it to the location of tanks, for example, or in percents of the ship's length as to where this bubbling was occurring?
It was an intermittent, it wasn't solid bubbling, it was intermittent, but it occurred along the entire length from the starboard tank, number one to number five.
And about how high did it bubble up?
I don't remember for sure. I think it was something like 6 inches to a foot. It was very irregular.
But it was a noticeable bubbling above the surface of the water that you could detect?
Yes, sir.
It did appear to be solid oil?
In the dark, I can't tell.
Okay. Did you see any oil running down the side of the ship when you arrived?
Nothing was running down the side of the ship. There was indications where something had run down the side of the ship.
And what location was that? Was it forward or midships? Or?
There was some in midships right near the pilot ladder. There was some aft, and I believe one or two small streaks forward.
About how wide were the streaks?
They varied. The ones forward were no more than 2 feet, most of them about 1 foot. Midships were the same, aft 6, 7, maybe 8 feet wide.
Were these streaks from oil that had been on deck that leaked over the edge of the ship?
It appeared to, yes, sir.
Was ever the possibility of fire a worry or a concern?
That was one concern, yes, sir.
Was it a very high danger or was it just a concern? If you could characterize it as whether it was a a possibility or a probability or?
It was a good possibility. Anytime you have the concentration of oil vapors, you have a possibility of fire.
Was it necessary to take any special precautions on the ship to prevent any ignition sources?
I didn't have to direct any more, no.
Okay. Did you witness any practice on the vessel that you asked the crew to desist from doing?
No.
Any open lights or flames or?
There were none.
Okay. Going back in my notes here, I noticed that one of the people you called early upon your arrival station was Commander Rome. Would you explain to us what Commander Rome's position was and why it was important to call him?
Commander Rome deals with marine environmental response at the district level and would coordinate notifications to other federal and state agencies.
All right. Environmental response, that is an overall category for oil spill response?
Oil spill response is part of it.
Part of it. When you went to the Exxon Valdez, were you accompanied by any representatives of the state?
Yes. Mr. Dan Lawn with the Department of Environmental Conservation.
And what were his duties on board the vessel?
He represented the state in the environmental response mode to monitor that adequate cleanup efforts were being taken.
He would monitor the cleanup efforts?
Yes.
In other words, he would observe from the vessel what they might consist of?
Correct.
Or ascertain the conditions. And okay. When you recall that morning, did you advise anyone to close the port?
I believe I advised Mr. Blanford that nothing should move in or out past that vessel.
With regard to closing the port, were you aware that the ice conditions were somehow related to the accident when you went out to the vessel?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Regarding ice conditions, are there any times when the port would be closed because of ice conditions? Have you ever known of any, I should say?
No.
How would you characterize ice navigation or ice problems in the traffic lanes going down through Valdez Arm? Is it something that's increasing? Is it seasonal? Can you generally describe it based on your 2 years of experience here or what you may have read?
Compared to the last few seasons, from what I've read, what I've been told, and what I've seen, it's a seasonal problem. This season, it appears to have started a little earlier than normal.
How does the Coast Guard Vessel Traffic Center receive and put out information on ice conditions?
We receive it from vessels that transit the area.
Are there any kind of Coast Guard surveillance or Coast Guard ice patrols or anything of this nature?
No.
Do you have any facilities or capability to do any surveillance for ice in Valdez Arm?
If it gets within range of our radars.
And about what would be the range of your radar to pick it up? I did have a question on that, and has this come up?
That's dependent on the conditions. I've seen it pick up icebergs in the arm itself, but that night I didn't recall seeing it on the radars.
Okay. About what has been the maximum range that you've seen ice picked up on the radar at?
I can't recall.
Okay. Do you have any feeling for how reliable the radar is at picking up ice? Are there times when there are ice reports but the radar is not holding it, such as the evening you're speaking of?
Yes.
Would you characterize it as more often than not it has ice, or more often it does have the ice if it's reported?
More often than not, we rely on the ice reports from the vessels.
Okay. So I could take away your answer then that it might be usual that the ice does not show on the radar?
Yes.
Regarding closing the port, is the port ever closed for wind conditions?
Yes.
Would you characterize what wind conditions exist to close the port?
We closed the port in January. We received reports of 93 knot wind gusts at the airport, which is to the east of our location, east of the Valdez Narrows. And at that same time, we were getting wind gusts reported in the Narrows in excess of 70 knots.
We can certainly see why you would close the port at 70-knot winds in the Narrows. What is the lowest threshold for closing the port?
That threshold is flexible. It would depend on the directions of the wind and the sea state.
I see. Is this, when you make a decision to close the port, is this something that's done in consultation, say, with the pilots or with the maritime interests? Or?
Yes, sir, it is. Is.
Do the pilots or maritime interests ever initiate closing the port for some reason?
They make a recommendation, and I believe they did that night. They recommended that the sea state was too rough and the winds were getting too high.
Okay, this is not the night, this is another night we're speaking of.
Right, the night when we did close the port for high winds.
Right. Just make sure we're clear. It does occur to me on icing, you say you never had to close the port for ice, to your recollection. Do you have any knowledge or recollection about the companies that had their vessels depart, say, during daylight due to ice during the ice season?
No, sir.
Have you received any recommendations regarding ice navigation from the pilots?
I don't know, sir.
Do you recall, from your vantage point on the vessel, witnessing the arrival of the Alyeska oil spill equipment?
Yes, sir.
About what time did that equipment arrive, and could you describe it?
Approximately 1500 is when I first saw it coming out of the arm and proceeding to the south of us. It was one of the tugs towing the barge, and I believe there were a couple of smaller vessels in tow, and there were some other smaller vessels trailing along farther back.
Okay. Did you witness them actually commit their oil cleanup operations or any booming operations?
They proceeded quite a ways to the south of us. I didn't watch their booming operations from the bridge.
Did you have any communications with them?
Not initially, no, sir.
Was there ever a time when someone from a helicopter queried the vessel, to your knowledge, about booming the ship?
I don't recall, sir.
You were not a party to any kind of conversation about that you can recall?
Not that I remember.
Did you at any time give any guidance or recommendations as to where the boom should be placed?
Not that day, no, sir.
Okay. Now that day was the day of the accident when the equipment arrived at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yes, sir.
Was there any recommendation to your knowledge not to boom the ship?
Not at that time that I can recall.
Would there have been any benefit in putting a boom around the ship?
That by the time they got out there with the equipment, no.
What, in your opinion, would have been the best location to place the booming equipment?
In my opinion, the best place would have been to locate the equipment at the head of the slick in an effort to try to corral it, contain it, prevent it from spreading further.
In what direction was the slick generally spreading?
Southwesterly.
Southwesterly. So it would be go down to the southwest and find the head of the slick and commits booming at that point, is what you're saying then?
Yes, sir.
Now, were you involved in making any suggestions or giving instruction regarding the lightering of the vessel?
Yes, sir.
Would you describe those events for us?
We were advised that the Exxon Baton Rouge, I believe, was going to be at Hinchinbrook entrance approximately 0800. And that's the vessel Exxon preferred to lighter to. There was some concern about getting that vessel light enough to come in and take on cargo. And it was decided that we needed to pump the dirty ballast out of her immediately. We didn't have time to wait until they could go to Alyeska Terminal and pump the dirty ballast ashore. So she was permitted to dump ballast in Prince William Sound.
And that was a Coast Guard decision that decided to deballast the vessel?
With the concurrence of the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Was there concurrence essential or necessary? Could the Coast Guard have also acted if they had chosen to?
Could have, but I'd already discussed it with Dan Lawn as a possibility, and we both agreed it was a necessity.
Okay. About what time that morning, to your recollection, did the ships, the emission of oil from the ship seem to slow down?
It seemed to stop boiling or bubbling or coming up from the sides. I think I noticed it somewhere between 9 and 10.
Did you make any calls to Exxon before you left the Marine Safety Office to go to the ship?
I don't think so, no, sir.
Okay. I have a somewhat different question. This is, perhaps I should ask, how long did you remain on the Exxon Valdez?
I left Sunday afternoon at about 15:30.
Okay. Do you recall sometime that day being at the Marine Safety Office and encountering a representative of the Upjohn Company?
Sunday evening, yes, sir.
Yes. What did he represent his purpose in being there?
To conduct an ordered test on two civilian watch standards.
Did he mention to you that he had been sent to do this and had been unable to make any transportation and had driven?
I believe he said he'd driven that day, yes, sir.
Did he have time to make any hotel reservations when he was ordered to travel to Valdez?
No, sir.
So he arrived with, did you assist him to acquire some accommodations?
Yes, sir. I don't know where we put him up, but I believe we put him in one of our quarters that night.
And what was his mission?
He was directed to take urinalysis samples of two civilian watchstanders, Mr. Taylor and Mr. Blanford.
And was this in relation to the accident?
Yes, it was.
What time did the Pacific Strike Team arrive back on scene?
They arrived Saturday morning.
What did the contingent consist of?
Four individuals from the strike team and some over-the-top, some ADAPS pumps.
How many ADAPS pumps?
We got two ADAPS pumps aboard the ship Saturday evening.
Okay. And when were they put into operation?
That evening.
Do you recall about what time that was?
I believe they got the first pump online about 2200.
And they were pumping to which vessel?
The Exxon Baton Rouge.
You're listening to live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board inquiry into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. The witness on the stand right now is Coast Guard Lieutenant Commander Thomas Falkenstein. He's the executive officer of the Marine Safety Office in Valdez. He's being questioned by the NTSB's chief investigator, William Woody.
Dr. LaResh.
Mr. Chairman, Commander. Just one question. You have said that you smelled alcohol on Captain Hazelwood's breath. Can you characterize that smell as a beer smell or a hard liquor smell?
I can't characterize it.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, we There was one more person on our panel that...
Dr. Berkey, did you have some questions to ask?
Yes, sir, if I may. Did you observe any other indicators that Captain Hazelwood may have been under the influence?
No, I didn't.
The only thing you observed was the smell and no slurred speech or any other indicators?
I just met Captain Hazelwood that night, sir, so I can't tell whether his speech was slurred or whether that was his normal dialect.
You indicated in regard to the testing of the watch standards and the Upjohn individual. Do you know when the decision was made to test those two individuals and who made that decision?
No, sir, I don't. Not by that individual.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the response.
Well, one of the individuals was tested twice.
Yes.
And I presume you're referring to the test by Upjohn?
I'm referring to the tests that were collected under the DOT employee testing program, which would be the Upjohn individual, yes.
No, sir, I do not know who made that decision or when they were ordered.
Are you aware of the DOT regulation regarding testing of their own employees?
Vaguely.
Are you referring to Exhibit 11? B is in boy. And if you could turn to the addendum to that exhibit, which should be at the back of the exhibit. Yes, 11B-1 is the exhibit, I beg your pardon. Do you have that, sir?
Yes, sir.
Could you turn to page Roman numeral 6-2, item 5 at the top of that? Do you happen to know if that decision to test those individuals was made within the 8-hour period after the notification to the Coast Guard?
No, sir, I do not.
So you have no knowledge how that decision was made or by whom?
No, sir, I do not.
When was that test, when were those samples collected, do you know?
Before 2030 on Sunday the 27th. Sometime between approximately 1800 and 2030.
On the 27th or the 26th?
7th, Sunday. 26th?
Pardon me?
26th.
Yes, I think it was 26th, was it not?
Right.
And it was between, what'd you say?
Between 1800 and 2030.
Do you know if those individuals were monitored during that period so that they would not have consumed any substance that would be illegal between the time of the incident and the time of the testing?
No, sir, I do not.
Do you know what the purpose of that testing was?
After the fact, yes, sir, it was for the testing of illegal drug consumption.
And you did not know that was what the purpose was initially?
No, sir. I did not know exactly what the test was for.
Whose responsibility is that in your office?
It's my responsibility to test the military employees. The civilian employees are tested by the area, which is out of Alameda, California.
If you look at the previous page to the
on the exhibit I just gave you or referred to. Under paragraph or section B, this is under post-accident testing, section B, paragraph 1, do you see that item there? First, the appropriate OA will determine whether the accident is a covered event.
Yes, sir.
Is that then your responsibility? Are you the OA individual that would make that decision whether they be tested or not to be tested?
What does OA mean?
It's a DOT document. I think it's organizational unit, as I understand it, organizational administration. Or
I don't understand what you're asking, sir.
I'm asking you if you're the individual that would make the decision to test the civilian VTSers under this under your organizational unit.
Potentially, yes, sir.
Okay. But you have not reviewed this document prior to this, is that correct?
Sir, I wasn't there when this was required to be reviewed and okay. The guy tested.
Okay. You indicated earlier the captain was reluctant to provide a urine specimen. Do you happen to know what his reluctance was?
No, sir, I do not.
Are you into the regulation on the testing of marine employees in the marine industry? Is the Coast Guard authorized under the regulation to require samples for toxicological testing?
It's my understanding in certain conditions, yes, they can.
What are those conditions?
In the event of a major marine casualty is one of them.
And would this classify as a major marine casualty?
Yes, it would.
So you would then be authorized to require specimens be collected?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. That's all I have.
We'll start with the parties again. Dr. Laresh, do you have any more questions? Thank you. Mr. Hallett?
Yes, thank you. Commander Falkenstein, you mentioned that in the morning you noticed that the oil had quit boiling up or bubbling up from the side of the ship, and it was moving off in a direction. Could you repeat what that direction was?
To the southwest.
And did that continue throughout the day?
Yes, sir.
You mentioned that you observed the Alaska barge arriving with the other oil spill equipment, and that they were moving off into a certain direction. What direction was that?
To the southwest.
Would that be toward the leading edge of the spill?
Yes, sir.
In another light, did you, while you were on the Exxon Valdez on that morning on Friday or in the afternoon, get a message from any of the ship's officers that you were to try to contact Alyeska?
Not that I recall, sir.
Did you have a method for contacting Alyeska? Had you established a method?
It would have been possible to call Alyeska via the MARSAT phone.
Okay, did you do that?
No, sir, not that I recall.
So you had no contact with Alyeska personnel on Friday?
I do not recall any, sir.
Thank you. That's all the questions we have.
Captain Deppe.
Captain William Deppe, the
when you went out
Exxon
the
representative is going to be
you said there were a lot of vapors around.
Going to be asking questions.
Were you ever worried about explosions or the boat having an explosion problem when you were coming alongside?
As we were coming alongside, sir?
Yes.
Not particularly.
Okay. Did you impose any safety precautions on board the vessel because of the vapors that you smelled?
No, sir, not over what the crew had already imposed.
Okay, that's all I've got. Thank you. Commander Waldron?
I have a question.
Mr. Colucciello?
No question.
Commander, I just want to ask you a question about the alcohol. Are you trained in alcohol detection?
No, sir, not formally.
We've heard from a number of witnesses who came in contact with the master, and they said that they were not aware of any smells, any odors of alcohol. And they also said, if I recall correctly, that the vapor smell were very strong. Could you smell alcohol over the vapors themselves?
The vapors on the bridge did not appear to be that strong when I arrived, and I could smell the alcohol. I was standing fairly close to the master in a confined spot.
I think you said within 2.5 feet, something like that?
Yes, sir. We were both on the bridge, near the glass at the front of the bridge on the port side.
So you smelled the alcohol, but you noticed no other characteristics?
No, sir, I did not.
Okay, I thank you. You're excused. I have 20 minutes after 12. What we're going to do today is take a lunch break for an hour and a half. We will return at 10 minutes to 2. However, I would like to meet at 1:30 with the four party coordinators in my room to discuss a few administrative issues. So at 1:30 in my room, and I'll give you that room number in just a minute, I would like to meet with the four party coordinators. See you at 10 minutes to 2.
You've been listening to live coverage of the NTSB hearing into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. Our coverage will continue at 10 minutes to 2. We heard on the stand today Lieutenant Commander Thomas G. Falkenstein, the first man on board the Exxon Valdez, one of the first two Coast Guard officials on board the Exxon Valdez after the wreck occurred. We heard him say that he did, in fact, smell alcohol on the breath of Captain Hazelwood. Earlier, the chief mate had testified that he did not smell alcohol on Hazelwood's breath. Chief Mate James R. Kunkel said that when he was on the bridge, the vapors from the petroleum, from the crude oil, were so strong that he could not have smelled anything. Lieutenant Commander Falkenstein said that by the time he got there, the vapors had dissipated to the point, and he had very clearly smelled alcohol, and so did the other Coast Guard safety officer who went with him, a Mark J. Delosier, who was the Chief Marine Safety Officer. We also heard a line of questioning that questioned whether the Coast Guard had tested its own civilian employees who were working for the Coast Guard, doing communications work at the time of the accident. They said that a representative of Upjohn Company had come to test those employees, and one of the lines of questions seemed to suggest that the Coast Guard, and Lieutenant Commander Falkenstein in particular, had not acted fast enough to get those tests underway. They tried to point out that under a Department of Transportation document, Falkenstein did have the authority to order tests of civilian employees. We'll be back with more live coverage of the NTSB hearing into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez at 10 minutes to 2. I'm Bruce Melzer. With me today has been Corey Flintoff. Coverage of these hearings come to you from KSKA Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.